tonight on Arena. Oscar-winning actress Penelope Cruz on her new film Parallel Mothers and working with Pedro Almodovar. Whether in action movies or a drama, playing a secret agent, a stressed-out single mother, or a grieving sister, Penelope Cruz is truly one of the most compelling film stars of our era. She won an Oscar for her role in Woody Allen's Vicky Cristina Barcelona in 2008, but it is her decade-long creative partnership with fellow Spaniards Pedro Almodovar that has perhaps brought her the roles that will define her legacy in films like All About My Mother, Pain and Glory and Volver. In Almodovar's new release, Parallel Mothers, which is set in Madrid, Penelope plays Janice, a photographer in her 40s who is thrilled to discover she is accidentally pregnant. Alongside her in the maternity ward is teenager Anna, played by Melina Schmidt, who is far from happy about impending motherhood. Through the film, their lives become intertwined in unexpected ways, and the story explores themes of personal truth, but also truth about Spain's dark past. Earlier, I spoke to Penelope Cruz, and I began by asking her about her working relationship with Pedro Almodovar.
Yeah, I think we've made 7 movies together, and one of them was a cameo, but I count that too. I count everything with him. And yeah, I was a huge fan of him since I was a very young girl. I grew up watching his films and really being his number one fan.
And how did you get to work with him then? You very much went on the offensive.
No, actually, he saw my first 2 movies that I did when I was 18. And they both came out at the same time. And I was very lucky because they were very different from each other. And they were very interesting. And he saw them and he called me. And when he called, I didn't believe it. When they told me he was on the phone, I thought it was a joke from my friends or my family. And it was him. And he asked me to get together. And then he said I was too young because it was for Kika. So I was not right for that character, and he said he would call me in the future, and then he did, and we did Lifeless, and we had a great connection from day one. It was like seeing somebody that I already knew.
What is it about him that gives him such great insight into women, do you think?
I think he's always been a great observer, and he's always been fascinated by human behavior, but especially the one of women and women's mysteries. And he always talks about his childhood, how in the village in La Mancha, he would just be out there in the middle of the street observing the relationship between the mother and the sisters and the neighbors. There was a lot of life, like right there in the street, out of the houses. And they would just sit there and talk. And I think he was always fascinated by them. The mother was a total character, was really special, really smart, funny, very loving woman, really strong. And I think she had a huge influence in him. She had a very original personality, very peculiar. But I met her, so I saw a lot of things in common, the two of them. And he put her in a lot of his films. And I think it comes from that. He just finds women fascinating. We are very lucky to have somebody like him that writes such incredible homages to women constantly.
And in Pain and Glory, he asked you to play his mother as a young woman.
Yeah, it was played by me in those years and then by Julieta Serrano, who is amazing. And the meetings that I've had with his mother before she died were also very helpful for me later to be able to play her, to be able to understand her.
And I think she was rather cautious about his film career early on before his great success.
Yes. When she talked to me, she was crying. She was saying that she was very emotional because he was being successful, and she was terrified when he told her that he was going to quit the job at the telephone company. She was terrified because she thought he was very safe there. And he took a risk and things were working out. So he was right. And she was crying, telling me this story. And for me, that moment was really special.
Now, he has written such extraordinary roles for you over the years, Volver, All About My Mother. Can you tell me your reaction when you read the script Parallel Mothers?
When I read it, I remember I sat in a sofa in my house. I read like all that. I could not put it down for anything. I could not believe it was such a perfect script, such an incredible story. I was so happy he was giving me this character. He's given me a few surprises like this, you know, with his films. I received one of these scripts and see that you have gold in your hands. And I feel very grateful that he trusts me for characters that are so complex and so incredibly interesting and always a huge challenge, kind of scary too.
Yes, your role of Janice is such a complicated, deeply interesting character. Now, it's difficult to talk about the central plot twist, which involves Janice and the teenager Anna. Maybe I'll give it to you. Can you give us a setup to give us as much as you can to whet our appetite?
After doing like 1,000 interviews for the film, I have realized that I cannot talk about the movie without sharing what happens at the beginning. And I think it's good to say it. I think it will bring more people to the cinema if they know that these two women meet at a hospital at the beginning of the film and their babies are going to be exchanged and they're going to find out or not later. I think without knowing this, without being able to talk about this, it's impossible to have a conversation about the film.
Oh, that's great relief. And that is why that's great. We can talk a little more openly now, Penelope. Yeah. Now, those early scenes, we know then, because when we're watching the film, first of all, the whole birthing process of both Janice and Anna are so you know, they're there in front of us. And then the whole bonding with their individual babies just hot out of the womb. And obviously, they are key scenes because of what's going to happen later.
They are. And I understand your relief because if I was a journalist and I had to talk about this, like escaping everything, forget it. Like there is no interview to do. So
thank you.
I think it's good. I think it would make people more interested. The beginning, in that hospital, you know something huge is going to happen. And then, but it's not just that. It's not like, oh, later they find out. They say, no, things are going to get so, so complicated. And that's why it was such an incredible adventure every day. Every process of the rehearsals, every day on the set, it was an incredible school for me.
So what was it like in that film delivery room? How did you and Almodovar, how did you work on that, making it authentic?
So I drove Pedro crazy with questions about, I need to know specifics, epidural or no epidural, how many centimeters of is she dilated when she's talking to her on the bed, this and that. And he was like, do you really need to know all those things? Like, okay, you make up your mind, whatever you think is right, because you have given birth twice. And I think he spent a lot of time asking questions to all of us, the ones that have given birth, because, you know, what you don't want to see in a film is a scene of a birth of any kind that doesn't have a sense and a credibility. So that's why we got very much into the details. And also Milena, who has not given birth, she also got together with a lot of doctors and a lot of women and talked to us about it. And for Pedro, it was the same. And I think it says a lot about him that he knows when... He's always answering questions to all the departments, but he knows there are moments where he's the one to ask the questions. And I think that is so crucial to be a good director, you know, to be also continue to ask questions sometimes.
So it's fair to say then that Janice becomes aware that there has been a switch, and she becomes very fearful that she might lose this child that she has bonded with. And so therefore, the complications in your character then, the character of Janice, is that she's acting with double intentions throughout the rest of the film.
Yeah, she has to become an incredible liar in her own life, in her own house, about what she loves the most, about her daughter. And she has to lie to people that she cares about. So we needed a lot of time of rehearsal. We were lucky to have like 4 months of rehearsal because the personality of Janice is very different from mine. And she is not allowed to express her feelings. And the same with Milena. He didn't want the two of us to be hugging and crying through the whole film. And we needed to find a tone and we needed to find restraint. And that was actually a lot of training. Instead of to find the emotion, it was the opposite. It was like training so that we could do the scene without crying. So that was like the first 2 months, it was impossible. Because Milena and I would start reading and just like start hugging and crying. And Pedro knew that that was gonna happen. But we needed to go through that process and find their way of expressing, which was different. And on top of that, when my character wants to express something real, she can't because she has to lie to all of them. And inside, she's dying of pain and fear. So it was challenging and it was an incredible adrenaline every day, but I enjoyed so much every second of this process.
Yes, and a fantastic watch because of that, because you're wondering, why is she doing that? And, you know, what is she trying to do? It's really so wonderful. But also Parallel Mothers addresses another, like Janice is keeping, she's a liar and she's keeping these secrets to herself. And Parallel Mothers addresses the whole legacy of the Spanish Civil War and how 114,000 went missing during Franco's rule. How difficult is it for Spain in general to engage with this awful history?
I think it depends on the person. I think Pedro's message in this movie becomes Janice's message and it's not about revenge. It's about inspiring a younger generation in terms of learning from the past, from all mistakes. And that, I think, goes for any country in the world right now. We all have story to look back and remember and learn from it. But it's not about political side, it's much more a message about human rights. And that's why I love so much that scene in the kitchen when she's getting angry with Anna. She's pushing her to react to that. But at the same time, she's lying in her face and she's like trying to provoke a reaction. So Anna would turn around and say, "What are you hiding? You are giving me this speech and really fighting for the truth and honoring the truth and the past. But what are you doing in this present moment? What are you hiding from me?" So I love the way it's written because she's really trying to provoke that situation because she can't handle anymore the lies. Janice can't live with that.
And the film builds up to the most extraordinary final scene. And I suppose it's about what has been buried all these years in Spain since the time of Franco and the Civil War before that. This must have been very moving both for the actors, for the director, for the whole crew. I don't need you to describe it, but it is about dealing with these disappeared people.
Yeah, it was very moving because we were there and we were watching, you know, the set and then the bodies, the real bodies, people that were there doing like an homage to all the people that disappeared. And especially to see the reactions of the little girl that seemed to understand everything and the past and the present and the future is all are in the eyes of that little girl. We don't know what happened because we were always trying to protect her. She was less than 2 years old. So always try to protect her so she wouldn't see anything that could impact her in a negative way. And when she was looking there, she only saw the real people. She didn't see, like, you know, bones or anything that could scare her. And that's the reaction that she gave us. So in her soul, she knew. It was, I think Pedro was so lucky to find that reaction from that girl. It's so important to have that at the end of the movie.
Penelope, I believe you live in Madrid now with your family. Was that for artistic reasons or for family reasons?
Well, first for family reasons, because most of the family is here. My brother lives in LA and I miss him very much, but we see each other when we can. And also we have a nephew from him now, but hope we see each other more. Now with COVID has been more difficult. But it's because most of the family is here and grandmothers, you know, are also important to be around, and aunts and uncles and cousins. And also I love my country. I love my city. I think that would be the main reason. But I also work a lot here, and I'm lucky that I'm able to work in all these different territories and different languages. I feel very lucky to have.
Yes, and we're lucky to see those films. Penelope Cruz, Parallel Mothers, opens in cinemas nationwide tomorrow. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and nice to meet you.
You too, Penelope. Thank you. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. And of course, Thursday night is movie review night. Up first is the film we've just been speaking about with its star Penelope Cruz. It's Parallel Mothers, Irish language film Dinan, starring Peter Coonan as Tomás, a prominent investigative TV reporter whose wife and baby go missing on a small island where they live, is our second film. And finally, children's animation Sing 2. Theatrical impresario Buster Moon, played by Matthew McConaughey, is back, giving animal friends the chance to follow their dreams in a new variety show. Just one problem: persuading a grieving lion and former rock star, played by Bono, to join them. Cara O'Doherty and Paul Whittington have been to the cinema for us. We'll start with Parallel Mothers. So Penelope Cruz gave us the scenario there. So it's the story of two women, Janice, who is played by Penelope Cruz. So tell us about the other mother and how they meet in hospital, Paul.
Well, they meet, Penelope Cruz is, her character Janice, her pregnancy is an accident, but she's quite happy about it. She's facing 40, but she wants to raise the child as a single mother. But in the hospital, she meets Anna, who's in a very different situation. She's played by Milena Schmidt. She's still a teenager. We find out that her pregnancy was not the result of a happy incident at all. She's dreading motherhood, obviously. And her mother, this histrionic theatre actress, is not supportive. So that's how they meet, and they bond, and they form this very strong relationship.
Yes, and you also see the bonding they have with the babies, which becomes important, because as Penelope gave us permission to say,
she gave it away,
the babies are switched.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And it's brilliantly done, and Almodovar does this time and again. He mixes these kind of Douglas Sirk type, you know, melodrama plots with very serious subjects underneath. He's done that more and more in his recent films. And that's a staggering moment. And the moment she starts to suspect is when Arturo, the husband, comes and says, "That's not my baby."
Yes, because the baby is a very dark child.
Yeah.
Penelope Cruz's character, Janice, believes it's because her father was said to be Venezuelan.
Yes.
So this all, but it plants questions in her own head.
Yep.
Isn't that right, Cara? And then the tension builds. How does Almodovar build that tension between the two girls without giving away too much plot?
I just have to say, I'm so glad Penelope did reveal that bit, because I was so worried about how we were going to talk about this without. So the way he builds the plot is that it's through their friendship gets stronger and stronger, but Janice keeps holding back this secret, and we know what's going on, and she doesn't know how to bring it up, whether she ever will. And I think the strength in it and the drama unfolds as their friendship changes, the dynamic changes between the two of them. I won't go into too much about that, but because we keep seeing that look in Janice's eyes, and we see her when she's by herself, and that we realise, you know, this is building into something very big, and he just does that so carefully. And with Penelope Cruz being such a great actor, being able to play that kind of friendship, the mothering role that she's playing, yet being torn apart by the secret.
Yes, and as Paul mentioned there are a number of models of different types of mothers. He was talking about Anna's mother, Teresa, who is career orientated, somebody who always wanted to be in the theatre, and having a teenage daughter who is now pregnant or with a small baby is inconvenient for her career path. And then there's Janice's mother, who was equally a kind of, you know, a Janis Joplin wannabe.
Yeah, and even within that, the Audemars has this great way of playing with mothers. Janice's best friend, Elena, is this wonderful, Rosa De Palma, who has played in many of his films. Mm-hmm. And she's there again, almost, she's a different type of mother figure. She wants to mother in that aunt way, as in, here's lovely clothes, here's this, that and the other, and now I'm not raising the baby. So we see all these different dynamics play in it. And I think that's that strength that he really knows. As Penelope said in the interview herself, he really understands women and knows that there are so many different ways of mothering, and there's no such thing as a saintly mother, and there's no such thing as the opposite of a saintly mother. There's just people trying their best, and we see that really well played out in those the different characters.
And in the middle of this, Paul, at the beginning and at the end particularly, Almodovar takes on the whole burden of the hidden past of Spain and the horrors of the disappeared during the Civil War. How does he do that, and how successful is it when we're so caught up in this melodramatic but wonderful drama of Anna and Janice?
Well, I think that in a way, by using the frame of the melodrama, he makes the historical and political aspect of the film more accessible to a wider audience. Early in the film, Janice berates Anna for not being sufficiently politically and historically engaged. And I think it's Almodovar talking to himself, because he knows that his early films were sort of cultural and social critiques of the Franco era. But this is very direct. And I think at first when I saw it, I thought, does he join the two together well? And some might say the ending is abrupt, but I think it's not. And there's this wonderful scene where he effectively confronts the ugliness of Franco Spain with the open-mindedness of the modern Spain that the Movida movement that he spearheaded helped create, because you get,
Movida movement.
The Movida movement. Happened in Spain in Madrid in the late 1970s, early 80s, and was all about the freedom of expression and the freedom of sexual expression. But there's this lovely scene where Janice's character, a couple of these people are lesbian, one or two are unmarried mothers, an illegitimate child, and they're standing in front of this grave, and it's the Spain of the present confronting the Spain of the past. It's brilliantly done, I think.
So stars out of five for you, Cara.
It's such a strong film with amazing performances, and that idea, that weight of history is carried so well. It could have been a five, but there's one thing that I can't talk about without spoiling, and I just think that one plot thread was just left to dangle a little, but otherwise it's a really a sort of irresistible, sucks you in, four-star film. Maybe even a little just over a four.
Right. And for you, did that?
So that was four and a bit.
Do you know what she's talking about? And do you agree?
I'm trying to guess, actually.
Yeah. I'll ask her afterwards. Okay.
Yeah, no, I nothing about that annoyed me. My only slight worry was the jolt towards the end, but I then realised that it was deliberate. So it's five stars for me. I love this film, actually.
Five stars. That's for Parallel Mother. The second film is we go to a tiny island off the coast of County Down, and another mother in trouble. Dinan is a thriller in which TV reporter Tomás, Peter Coonan, who we spoke to during the week, finds his own life under scrutiny when his wife Siobhan, played by Claire Munnelly, and baby son Oisin vanish while he's at work on the mainland. Cara, I mean, Irish language films are having such a moment. We had Aracht. Then I've just heard that Colleen Kuhn, which is based on Claire Keegan's Foster, is going to open the Dublin Film Festival. It's in a good place at the moment, isn't it?
It's a fantastic time, and I have to admit, my Gaeilge has lapsed a lot over the years, but I'm so glad to see this. And what I loved was what the more I'm seeing it, the more is coming back. So even watching this film, I became less reliant on the subtitles as it was going along. And it's lovely to know it's still in there somewhere. So it really is great to see this revival, and I hope it continues, because there's a strong batch of films representing the Irish language. So yes, let's have more of it, please.
Now, a bit like Parallel Mothers, and this time Peter Coonan didn't give us permission to do many spoilers. What is the family situation about Siobhan and the baby at home? Like, the Tomás character is worried about his family before he has to go to the mainland. Cara.
Oh, sorry. I thought that was sort of for Paul. Sorry. So Peter Coonan plays Tomás, and he's worried about Siobhan. She seems depressed. She's a bit confused. She's doing things like leaving a bottle of ketchup in the shower, the shower gels in the fridge. And there's all the kind of signs that there's some form of postnatal depression going on. When he talks to her, there's just something just not right. And when he does have to go over to the mainland, he works as an investigative reporter. So he has to hop over to talk to a source. And he's very insistent that he won't be long, he'll be back as quick as possible. And while he's over there, he takes the time to pop into a GP to talk about the situation. He says they've moved to the island to get some peace, but he's very concerned because something is not right with his wife and child.
OK, well, we have a clip, and we have just picked out some English language clips. But as you say, the Irish is very understandable, even for people who are a little rusty. But anyway, in this, we hear a section of Tomás, who's worried and he's kind of losing it on the phone. And then we go to Leisha, who is the island's keeper of the law and order, and she looks for help from the mainland. This is after it's got out that the mother and child have disappeared.
Bernie, it's his move.
If so much as a hair on the head of that child is harmed, I'll kill you my fucking self. Fuck! Fuck!
Leisha, you enjoying life off the grid? Still a maverick working against the system.
It's called retirement, son. Or it would be, if you lot would send over some youngster to fill my boots.
Oh, listen, Leisha, we've a lot on down here. A lot of work to do. I don't really have time for a chat. What do you need?
I need a forensics team, some medics, and a few of your best men on the island as soon as possible. Maybe send some sniffer dogs too.
What's all this? Stolen lawnmower? Somebody messing with Patter's lobster cages again?
Murder? Possibly plural. Certainly one murder and two missing people. And they are pots, not cages.
Breach Brennan as Alicia there, and Peter Coonan as Tomás in Dinan. So Breach Brennan as Alicia, she's an interesting keeper of the law. She's not quite, is she a Garda or is she?
No, I wasn't quite clear on that. I don't think she is a Garda, but she is a representative of the law and she does have some authority. I think she's one of the strengths of this film, actually. And I actually spoke to Peter Coonan as well during the week, and apparently Breach Brennan is not a Gaelgore, and she learnt this Donegal dialect for the film, and it sounded pretty good to me. I'm not an expert, but I think she's great in it, and we're not given too much information about her. She's kind of an enigma, and where he's, as you can tell there, he doesn't sound too happy, does he, Tomás? But she is quiet, watchful. She's like this little island, as it were, in the centre of this coming storm, which everybody's talking about. I thought she was very good in it, actually.
And the tension presumably builds. There's a mother and a child missing, and presumably the clock is ticking.
The clock is ticking. ticking and the plot thickens as well. And actually, the first half of the film is strong. I think that on not a very big budget, Damien McCann sets out his stall very nicely. It looks like a sort of, you know, Scandi noir almost. And I think they shot up around Strangford Lock, didn't they? But it really does feel like that sort of slight sense of sort of paranoia that you can get on an island.
There's a lot resting, Cara, on Peter Coonan, isn't there? How does he perform?
Oh, Peter Coonan has that very clever way of going from very charming, very calm, very sedate, and then, as we heard in that clip, completely losing the plot a few minutes later. And we never really know where we stand with him. We know his wife and child are missing. Leisha starts to think that it could be something to do with his work as an investigative reporter. He's looking into some very bad people, so is it connected to that? But it's that skill that Peter Coonan has of he keeps us guessing. It's very hard to read what's going on, which is what you want in a mystery like this.
Okay, so stars from you, Cara, for Dinan.
Do you know, I think I'm going to go with the 3 stars, but I do think it's very atmospheric. There's some great moments in it, and it's a really strong first film from Damien McCann. I really want to see what he does next, because I think there's a good filmmaker in there, and I think a bit more work, and he'd be hitting the 4 stars.
Yes, I think there are jump out of your seat moments, but it's hard to sustain.
It's hard to sustain, and in fact, the plot really doesn't it doesn't work hard enough to sustain the 90-minute film, but I did like a lot of the way it was made and the performances, so 3 stars for me as well.
3 stars, so 3 from both of you from Dinan, and that's in selected cinemas. Finally, tonight's kids' movie, Sing 2, in which Bono plays the reclusive lion and rock star Clay Calloway, who has to be persuaded out of retirement by Matthew McConaughey's impresario. He's a koala bear, Buster Moon. Remind us of the original film, Paul. It was released in 2016.
Yeah, and it was kind of, I mean, it was enjoyable and in a kind of forgettable sort of way. And it was basically, it's this world in which only animals exist, which must be lovely. And it took on the talent show, basically, the TV talent show. And Buster Moon played this owner of a theatre, or Matthew McConaughey, rather, was Buster Moon, the owner of a theatre. And he puts on a talent show and he offers too much money accidentally. And loads of people show up, and some of them are very talented and they form a troupe. And in this film, they decide to put on a show. Basically, that's the plot, putting on a show.
Okay, so I named Bono, obviously, and Matthew McConaughey. Tell me about some of the other stars in the cast, Cara.
So we have Reese Witherspoon plays Rosita, and she's a pig. And the last time we saw her struggling, she's got about at least 20 piglets. And she was an ordinary mammy with a great voice. And through Buster, she now is able to take to the stage despite having a million piglets hanging out of her. Taron Egerton is Johnny. He's a gorilla, and he's from a family that wouldn't support his musical endeavours. But again, through Buster, he now can do his gorilla singing every night. And we've got Scarlett Johansson, who is Ash the porcupine. And she's a proper little rock star who is very excited to hear that Clay Calloway, this mysterious aging rocker, might come and join them. And it's a combination of Ash's determination and Buster as they try to get Clay Calloway, or Mr. Bono, back onto the stage.
To see, I'm confused is an understatement, but we'll play a clip. Here's Buster Moon and his troupe. They've sneaked in for an audition with Entertainment Mogul by Jimmy Crystal. They try to sell him an idea for a show that maybe they haven't quite developed properly.
So what's the show called?
What's it called? Gunther, you want to tell Mr. Crystal what it's called?
Uh-huh, it's called Out of This World.
Out of This World.
That's right. Just imagine it.
Ash?
Yeah, I got it.
A spectacular musical that takes your audience out of this world.
I wanna run.
I want to hide.
I wanna tear down the walls that hold me inside.
I love this song.
I wanna reach out and touch the flame where the streets have no name.
There's the troupe from Sing 2. So I suppose it's appropriate now to talk about Bono's involvement.
Yeah, that wasn't him singing there, as you may have guessed.
No, but he is in the background somewhere waiting to come on, or to refuse to come on.
Yeah, he's this very reclusive. His wife died, basically. He's a lion. Let's get that out of the way. And his wife died 15 years ago, and he has lived in his house and repels all intruders. And eventually, well, no, I won't give the plot away. Will they persuade him to take part? So Bono, he doesn't get lots of lines. We do get to hear him sing at the end, which is nice. And there is some low comedy, as there was in the last one, from watching animals perform pop songs.
All right. And are we playing with the Bono persona?
Well, I don't know if we are or not, because the lion doesn't seem all that Bono-esque. So we're then in the confusing situation. When he does eventually sing, he sings a U2 song. And I'm thinking, why is Calloway singing a cover song? But I think I'm overthinking it.
All right. Is he overthinking it, Cara, or was that a problem for you too?
It's
very deep tonight.
Yeah, I think we can give Sing an outbreak there. And well, we're talking about singing animals here, so I don't think we need to go too far into the psyche of the whole thing.
Okay, so let's play another clip. Ash and Buster visit Clay Calloway, played by Bono, to convince him to be in the show. Here, Ash and Clay Calloway find Buster hiding in a suitcase, hiding from Jimmy Crystal. Clay Calloway is not impressed. There is a ring on the doorbell, and it is the rest of the performance troupe. They're all bowled over when they see the veteran rock star, Clay Calloway, answer the door.
Buster?
Ash?
Ash, in here!
Buster?
You gotta be kidding me.
Hold still. What are you doing in there?
Ash, it goes off. Crystal got mad and tried to kill me.
What?
I thought you were thugs. Coming here to finish me off. Oh no. It's them.
Shh. Pretend we're not here.
The first time I leave home in 15 years, and what do I find? The show's off, and this guy's hiding in a suitcase.
No, no, no. Don't open the door.
Clay Calloway.
I remember you.
So Clay Calloway is Bono, mm-hmm. there, and he's inhabiting a role that is not himself.
I suppose that is not himself. He goes for a low register when he's doing his lines, and sometimes I was going, say what you say there, but I thought that, you know, he was perfectly competent. It was nice to hear him sing. It might have been nice to hear him sing more. He sounded good when he did.
Yes, he's doing a lot of introspection about his singing voice.
And oh, he is. Yeah, yeah, he is. Yeah. Yeah, he is. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's quite a gloomy character to be with, actually, and he only warms up towards the very end. But yeah.
Clay Calloway or
Clay
Bono?
Calloway.
Calloway. All right. Yes. And Cara, how did you find him in the role of Clay Calloway?
I thought he was a lovely lion altogether. he's a lovely character, and actually I think he just has this such gorgeous mane that there's a kind of a gentleness in there, and I don't know whether Bono had anything to do with the creating of the physical look of the character, but he's very growly as a lion would be, but there's a soft side in there as well, and I thought he was a nice Bono-y lion. And there's a
so
line.
So you said nice
a
lot of times, Cara. So I guess you're going to give it a high mark.
Do you know, I think I had a very soft spot for this. I liked the first one. I mean, it's very noisy. It's you know, it's not for. It's a bit of a sugar rush, so it's not going to be for everybody. But I'm going to give it 3 stars. But I think there's an awful lot going for it. But they have at least 30 pop songs tied in there. And they have this great message about authenticity. And I think it's time that they took a chance and started writing their own songs. Because if they had original numbers combined with those characters, I think they could really make something very special. But they're relying a bit too much on the old chart tops there now. Well, apart from Bono, obviously, we let them have their own songs in there. We don't want so.
But overall, Paul?
I actually watched it in a cinema full of children, and I think that there are things to like in it. It's a bit of a busy fool as a film, like it kind of it's doing too much all the time, but there's nice stuff in it, and some of the songs. I agree with Cara, it would be nice if there'd been a few original songs, so 2.5 stars for me.
Two and a half and three. So that's Paul Whittington and Cara O'Doherty. Thank you very much. It's coming up to 10 to 8. Pam and Tommy is a new TV series on Disney+. In the mid-1990s, Pamela Anderson was an international star, having starred alongside David Hasselhoff in the beach rescue series Baywatch. When she married Motley Crue drummer Tommy Lee, there was a media feeding frenzy around the relationship. A sex tape filmed by the couple during their honeymoon was stolen from their home by a disgruntled contractor. The video, that began as an underground bootleg VHS, grew into a global sensation when it hit the new World Wide Web in 1997. An 8-part series looks at the intersection of privacy, technology and celebrity, tracing the origins of our current reality TV era, or so the makers of this series say. It stars Lily James as Pamela Anderson and Sebastian Stan as Tommy Lee. I'm joined by Jen Gannon, who's been watching Pam and Tommy for us. There's a lot of TV series at the moment. I suppose the most recent, Impeachment, that looks at fairly recent cultural history as meat for a TV series. Is this another example of this?
Yeah, Ryan Murphy has a lot to answer for. I call it the Ryan Murphy televisual universe at this stage, because we had it with The People versus O.J. Simpson, the assassination of Gianni Versace, and then, as you said, the new impeachment about the Clinton-Monica Lewinsky scandal. But with Ryan Murphy, the breadth of these stories, he manages to shine a light or assimilate, you know, various themes within them, because with OJ, you had, you know, the lens kind of turned on racism and sexism throughout the 90s, the influence of tabloid culture, the rise of tabloid culture in a way. And then with Versace, there was a focus on the AIDS epidemic and homophobia. And then impeachment, he wanted to make sure that it was told through the perspective of the women who were affected by the scandal, to give them a voice. So I can see why the makers of Pam and Tommy thought this particular story was ripe for retribution, because it takes place in and around the birth of the internet in 1995. And delves into that mystery of celebrity and how celebrity control was decimated by the internet. But it's not the same thing at all.
For people who don't remember Baywatch as well as some of us, you might just fill us in on who Pamela Anderson and Tommy Lee are.
Yeah, so Pamela Anderson was a Playboy model. Famously, she featured on the cover of Playboy 14 times. And at the time in the 90s, I think she was a breath of fresh air in the way that she never hid her past. She managed to get hired in on Baywatch, but before that she was on a sitcom as well. And she seemed like this very fun-loving, fresh, new kind of actress. And Tommy Lee, he was a drummer in Motley Crue, and he had a very tumultuous reputation, a raucous reputation, as all of Motley Crue do. If you ever read the biography The Dirt, which is a classic rock biography.
Or listen to their songs.
Or listen to their songs, Girls, Girls, Girls. So when the two met, they basically had a whirlwind romance and ended up getting married within 4 days of meeting each other. So
OK, hold on now, because we have a clip of the meeting. Shortly after Pam, that's played by Lily James, and Tommy, played by Sebastian Stan, meet for the first time, Pamela has to go to Mexico for a work trip. Tommy follows her with his boys. Let me warn you about some strong language.
You crazy?
Kinda, yeah.
How do you find me?
Easy, just call every hotel in the Cancun area.
Oh my God.
9 times the charm.
Well, you do get points for effort, but you are still not coming down.
You're right. Because I'm already here.
No, you're not.
I'm here.
What?
You don't believe me?
Shut up.
Hear that? That's fucking Mexico. Hey! What's up, amigos? Yo soy Tommy Lee. El mucho sexy drummer de Molly Cruz. Woo!
Where are we all hanging tonight?
We all?
Yeah. You and your girls and me and my boys.
Your boys?
Yep. Come on, I wasn't gonna come solo. I didn't want you to think I was some crazy psycho stalker.
Huh, wouldn't want that.
So where are we going?
Tommy, I'm here for work.
One drink.
No, I'm in a thing.
And you're bored out of your skull.
No, I'm not.
So are.
How do you know?
Kept you on the phone this long, haven't I?
Sebastian Stan as Tommy Lee and Lily James as Pamela Anderson. Now, there's nothing subtle about Tommy, as we heard there, neither in his performances as a singer or in how he dresses around the house. He seems to, you know, favour a thong at all times.
Fond of the banana hammock, as it was probably called back then. Yes. And that's the thing. The tone of this show is very cartoonish. It's quite clownish. But that's a problem for me. And I think that's really down to Craig Gillespie. Craig Gillespie is the director of the show, and he also did the biopic of Tonya Harding, I, Tonya, which I had a real problem with because of its very strange tone, because it swings from you are thinking about Tonya Harding as this figure of fun for about 90 minutes of the film itself, and you're laughing at her, and then all of a sudden she is the victim of domestic violence, and the tone switches very sharply, and it made me uncomfortable because you're ridiculing her on one hand and then you're sympathising or empathising on the other. It doesn't ring true, and I think this is the same with the characterisation that they do of Pamela Anderson in the show, which is very disappointing.
Now, people who are going to start watching this series are going to get a bit of a shock in episode one, because there's a lot of Tommy, there's very little of Pam, and there's an awful lot of a carpenter that they bring into the house. What's the importance of him?
This is very, this is what one of my main problems with the show is, because it is based on a Rolling Stone article about Rand Gauthier, who was the disgruntled carpenter who was working in Pamela and Tommy's house and was fired. And his revenge on, you know, Tommy Lee, who withheld payment from him, was to steal his safe, and within the safe he discovered the sex tape, and that tape was made privately. It was a private honeymoon. It wasn't the dynamic has changed, because now we have Kim Kardashian and Paris Hilton, and they're in on selling the distribution of their sex tape, but this wasn't the same thing. This was stolen property. And the thing is, Pamela Anderson didn't want any part in this series at all, because she said the events that happened were traumatizing for her, and it, you know, her career took a real knock from the sex tape completely, because she wasn't legitimized as an actress then. When she wanted to move the stepping stone after, you know, Baywatch to go into film, she was turned down because of this sex tape, because she had this kind of reputation that people assumed. And even in the 90s, women couldn't walk through the world in that way that they, you know, can kind of more do that now, have ownership over their sexuality. And I think the reason why they're concentrating on Rand, who's played by Seth Rogen, and Seth Rogen is such a lovable actor, that they're imbuing this character of Rand, who is, you know, a parasite who stole this sex tape for money. They're imbuing him with that characteristic that make him kind of lovable and knockabout.
You think it's a psychological background for him about how his father used to have, you know, women at home, and he might have seen them in compromising positions. Like, as though he needs a backstory to make him, I don't know, are we supposed to like
this
him and
it.
Understand
I think
him?
We're supposed to. And because Rand agreed to actually the story of, you know, this series being made, this show is centred on Rand, and, you know, it makes him a kind of an anti-hero in a story about this. He deliberately stole this sex tape and to humiliate a woman that wants no part in the show. And I think, you know, in a post-Free Britney world where women are actually having their own voices and sharing their own stories, this is the wrong tack to take with a show like this. And I think, you know, I don't really care about him. He's so opportunistic.
Well,
and
you mightn't care, but there's
pointless.
A lot of him. So let's have a listen to him. This is Rand, played by Seth Rogen. He figures out he's stolen the sex tape at this stage, and he's trying to figure out how he can sell it, and he's trying to explain this new phenomenon of the internet to his partner, Uncle Miltai, and there's some strong language in this clip as well, let me warn you.
What? A what site?
A website. It's this thing on the computer. People will go to it. They will order the tape directly from us.
Okay, and how does somebody find this?
They will find it on a search engine like Yahoo or Alta Vista.
Mm-hmm. And how do they know to search for the tape if they don't even know it exists?
They don't have to know. And that is the beauty of the web. It's like this, man. It's like this. You're on your computer and you go on the search engine and you just type what you want to see. Okay? Pam Anderson. And up we pop.
I don't get it.
You don't have to get it. I get it, and so do 30 million other people.
30 million?
That's how many are on the web worldwide right now, and we can reach every single one of them.
How are you gonna... That's gonna cost a fortune.
It is free. The World Wide Web is free.
We still need money, though.
Yeah.
Manufacturing, mm-hmm. Shipping.
We do. We need an investor, but that's just any asshole with deep pockets.
I know people like that.
Seth Rogen there as Rand and his pal, played by Nick Offerman. I suppose it is a very important cultural moment when you see what has happened with the internet and how people's privacy is no longer private.
Yeah, I mean, that is the part of that the show. The concept around the show is supposed to be that it is a flashpoint in pop culture that served as this kind of harbinger for things to come. You know, the rise of YouTube, the rise of, you know, the ongoing phenomenon that is Kim Kardashian and the Paris Hiltons of these worlds who were, you know, part of the creation of their sex tapes and how they wanted to further their career using a sex tape, whereas it wasn't the same for Pamela Anderson. It ended up, you know, being part of this notorious sex tape. She was derided for it.
Now, Lily James plays Pamela Anderson. How does she imbue the role?
It's an astonishing transformation. And I think, you know, the prosthetics and the wigs and the makeup, that work is unbelievable. And she has the mannerisms and the voice down pat. But because it's such a drastic change in her looks and the way that the makeup is done, it also feels like another level of dehumanisation of Pamela Anderson as well, I feel. They don't give her any kind of recourse until one episode. There is one episode told solely from her perspective.
And Jen, sorry I have to stop you now, but overall, worth a watch?
I just think people will tune in for Lily James's transformation and maybe like the pop hits that are played throughout it. But, you know, this story maybe didn't really need to be told. There is a story about Pamela Anderson that does need to be told by Pamela Anderson.
OK, Jen Gannon, thank you. Pam and Tommy airs on Disney Plus next week. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Leah Murphy and Paula Shields. Paddy Carney was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's show was produced by Ola McGowan.